On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the dominance of the New York Knicks as they await their finals opponent. We also look into the story that broke the internet. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander keeps falling down. All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, we are joined every Wednesday, but this time it's a Thursday, by your man, my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on?
Tom, we did it. We are within arm's reach of another NBA Finals. We have this titanic series between the Thunder and Spurs still going on, but winding toward its conclusion. We have an Eastern Conference Finals representative, an Eastern Conference winner that I don't know that I would have imagined ever possible. And yet here we are. And I am excited to talk to you about it because I've been watching it up close and I would love to see it from somebody else's vantage point. So hit me with it, Tom. What is this week's big number?
Yeah, this week's big number is a big one, okay? It is plus 262. That is the point differential. The New York Knicks over the last 11 games entering the NBA Finals. And as you like to say, Dan, if that sounds like a big number, that's because it is. It is the record in NBA history. We have not seen a team over any 11-game span, whether that's regular season or postseason, have this much of a beatdown on opponents. Plus 262, 11-0 for the New York Knicks, and it's not even close. So I want to kind of put it in perspective what this plus 262 number in the playoffs, how it compares to all the great teams in NBA history, Dan. So when you look at this, plus 262 for the New York Knicks this year, the KD Warriors were plus 190, and that was the record before this Knicks team came around with Mike Brown, and they've obliterated that number. The Warriors did win the championship that year. The 71 Bucks also plus 172. They won the championship. The peak Kobe, Shaq, Lakers plus 170 over an 11-game stretch, and they won the championship that year for the three-peat. And then you also have the 2017 Cavaliers plus 170 going into the NBA Finals, facing none other than the number one team on this list entering this season, the 2017 KD Warriors. So the only team on this list that didn't win the championship is the one that faced the actual better team in this margin. So Dan, did it feel like 262 win differential? You've been covering the Knicks all postseason long, been at every home game. Is it felt like this is the greatest run in NBA history for the playoffs?
I would say it has felt that it has felt like they have really opened up the can, especially in closeout opportunities. It has felt like they see an opening and they seize it. They see a chance to go for the throat and they do not pass it up, which is a pretty dramatic change, right? I've also been at Madison Square Garden in the last several years where they've dropped a number of home playoff games, right? I've watched this team have a number of situations where they kicked away an opportunity, right? And they very nearly did that in game one against the Cavs. You know, you go down 22 in that game, like if that outcome flips, so much about what we know about the Knicks right now or what we think we know about the Knicks could be very different. I think what I've seen, especially these last two rounds, we know the way they attacked Philly, the way they attacked Cleveland is like an onrushing wall of water that is finding whatever crack is available in the dam. You know, like there is, if they start from the position of we're going to run the high Brunson pick and roll, right? All right, you got a way to sort of glove that up. All right, boom, we're going to cat at the elbow or in the pinch post. We're running that high post hub offense through him and down, you know, cutters down through the lane. And we have all these different ways to attack. All right, you are going to sort of mess with that. All right, you're going to go ghost Josh Hart. You're going to have your big sag off of him. Okay, now we've got counters and ways we can do that. And, you know, it started at being an issue for them in the series. And then by the end of it, they were carving that coverage up. Like there are just, you want to run us a defense at us that is going to exploit us having a non-shooter on the floor. Okay, out goes Josh Hart, in comes Landry Shamet, who apparently cannot miss a three, or in comes Deuce McBride, who gives us like a point of attack, 94 foot past end, can knock down threes. Like, there are so many ways for them to attack, and their defensive work, like, they've been an excellent defense. I think they finished 10th in non-garbage time defensive efficiency during the regular season, but they've been significantly better than that from like January on. They've been awesome in this postseason. They've got a lot, you know, they can play at the level, they can play in a drop, they can have their wings switch. Obviously, OG Anunoby and Mikal Bridges and Josh Hart are sensational point of attack defenders, but also really great help defenders, disruptive off the ball. Like, there's just, they feel like a team that has the answers to a lot of different tests. And I think if you sort of stack that up over these individual games, over these individual like quarters and runs, like, they now regularly just have like an 18-1 run, a 20-0 run, a 34-9 run in these games. And it doesn't feel like, it's not like the Curry flurry runs, right? Where like Steph would just hit 9 threes in a row and you're like, well, all right, we lose. But it's the sort of accrual of these little advantages over and over and over again that seems to just, like, they have basically made these three straight teams quit. By the end of that series against Atlanta, the Hawks were just like, they were completely swept out of the room. Like, there was no chance after that first quarter for the Hawks. Against Philly, by the time you got to game three, the series was over. Against the Cavs, like, they came out pretty well in the beginning of game four, but midway through the second quarter, that game was over. Like, it is starting to feel like that. And that is a different feeling as somebody who has watched an awful lot of Knicks basketball over the years and has covered a lot of Knicks basketball over the years. But at a certain point, it's sort of like, maybe this is who this team, this iteration of this team is and has become. And it's been pretty remarkable to watch.
Yeah, like, the LeBron 2017 Cavs is an interesting comp here, is that they destroyed the Boston Celtics. They won by double digits in every one of that series. And they beat Toronto, the pants off of Toronto, LeBronto, all that. And then they just ran into this juggernaut, the KD Warriors, after the Warriors lost in 7 games to Cleveland. And so it's like, as much as I want to say the Knicks should be the favorites in the NBA Finals because of that plus 262 point differential, they've gone 4-game sweeps in the last two, and then against the Atlanta Hawks, who's completely blew them out down the stretch there, I still just kind of feel like they're the regular season did happen. It did happen. They weren't the best team in the East during the regular season. They weren't even the second seed in the East in the regular season. They had home court advantage in each of these three playoff series, which they won't have in the finals. But that point differential is so astounding. Like, it really is. And you can't even say, Dan, that they got injury luck on their side. Yeah, Jason Tatum didn't play in that series against Philly in that, the last game there. So maybe if Jason Tatum plays, then the Knicks are playing the Celtics, and maybe it wouldn't be so easy. But the knock on the Cavs over the last couple years is, yeah, their shortcomings in the playoffs, but they were full squad. They had all their guys in this series, and they still got swept and embarrassed in this round, which makes me feel like it. All the cards that you want to play against the Knicks, that this was too easy of a path, it's the East, then why weren't people picking a sweep before this series? And I picked the Knicks in 5 in this series, and I felt pretty solid about that pick, but they did way better against the Cavs than I suspected. And over this 11-game series stretch, in which they're 11-0, the plus 262, want to kind of put that in perspective a little bit more. In that span, Dan, Jalen Brunson has made 26 fourth-quarter baskets for 57 points, which means you could zero out all of Jalen Brunson's fourth-quarter baskets over that 11-game span. He could shoot 0-for-36 in the fourth quarter in that 11-game span, and they'd still have the record for the largest point differential in the last 11 games. So if you took out all of those 57 Jalen Brunson fourth quarter points in the 11 game stretch, they'd still be at 205. No team has been over 200 in any 11 game span in the playoffs until this team, and they're at 262. So like if you, and by the way, on that hypothetical, if he shot 0 for 36 and got zero offensive rebounds for the team and it just zeroed out all those possessions, they'd still have the record. So it's just like,
it's wild, man. It's extraordinarily wild.
It's wild. And so now they wait. They play the waiting game, Dan. And Ben Rohrbach at Yahoo did this great breakdown this week. He looked at every final since 2000 and looked at when you saw situations like this where one team has a huge rest advantage, does it turn into rest disadvantage or basically rust? And what he found was on teams that had at least three more days rest than their opponent in the NBA finals leading up to the final stage, that team was 9-5. But if you kind of whittle that down and just look at the teams that had an extraordinary rest advantage of 5 days or more, because the Knicks have 8 days rest going into the NBA finals, it evens out to 3-3. So there does seem to be a little bit of evidence here that the Knicks are going to guard against a rust issue going into the NBA finals against the winner of this Spurs Thunder matchup. And yeah, if you want to say, hey, a little bit of rest is good, 9-5, that's a pretty good ledger. More than 4 days rest going into the NBA finals doesn't seem to be much of an advantage. And what's interesting here is the teams, think about it, the teams that have a long rest period going into the NBA finals are usually teams that are beating the pants off of their opponents, right? So it's usually a 4-game right. sweep or a 5-game sweep. And so baked into this number is this team is super hot. It destroyed their conference finals opponent to the tune of a 4-game sweep or a 5-game series. So even baking that in, we're seeing that it isn't a huge advantage of getting a week off heading into the NBA finals. So now that you're feeling it, Dan, after covering the Eastern Conference finals, we have a little bit of respite here. Are you looking at the Knicks and saying, yeah, the 262 is the primary number to look at in this NBA finals? Or is it maybe the rest disadvantage that it turns into rust?
I think the rest versus rust question is very interesting. I thought Ben did a great job of contextualizing the recent history there. I think one thing that'll be really interesting to see is like the Knicks, unlike some of these other teams, have an object lesson in what it's like to have this time. Like they swept the Sixers and had, I think it was 9 days from the game four in Philly to game one against the Cavs. And they did come out a little bit sluggish and they weren't quite as sharp as they would have liked to have been in game one. And they needed that huge fourth quarter comeback to beat the Cavs in game one. So it was funny to me that like right after the game, when Karl Anthony Towns took the podium with OG Anunoby, they were both talking about like, we know and we want to get back to work. Like we know what happened last time and we felt a little less sharp and maybe our scrimmages, the way we did things, like we might want to switch things up. Like they can iterate on a process that they just went through, having now swept two consecutive series and having an example of like, okay, that maybe didn't work. That part maybe did. I think the other nice thing here is I think at the beginning of the Cavs series, you saw for the Knicks, like OG Anunoby coming off that hamstring strain, a little bit tentative with his movements, a little, you know, not quite as explosive. By the end of the series, you were seeing him explode to the basket for two-handed dunks. You were seeing him fly around the court in transition on the defensive end. So more time for him to rest up that hamstring, I think nothing but a good thing in that respect. And then the health component, yeah, like, yes, the Knicks will have had a longer layoff. You're also talking about potentially shorter turnarounds for an Oklahoma City team where Jalen Williams is dealing with his own hamstring issue, the recurring hamstring issue there, AJ Mitchell, the calf strain, or San Antonio where De'Aaron Fox is playing through what's been reported as a high ankle sprain, and Dylan Harper, you know, with his own issues there. Like there's stuff on either side of the Western Conference Finals, and the Knicks have a relatively clean sheet there. So I think those things are notable. To your point, though, about, and it's interesting because we've talked about this on the big number. you can slice the data and say for the last 4 months, right, going back to mid-January, the Knicks are neck and neck in terms of, you know, record winning percentage, including the postseason results with the regular season, neck and neck in winning percentage with Oklahoma City and San Antonio. They're actually ahead of them, and to go by PBP stats, in offensive rating and defensive rating and net rating over that span. Like the Knicks over the last, whatever that is, 55 games or so, it's not a sizable gap between them and the two leaders in the West. However, as we've talked about before, the more relevant sample is the full season sample, right? Like you can't just say, if you take out the part where the Knicks were 2-9, they're awesome. Yeah, they did go 2-9 after the NBA Cup, which we talked about here, that swoon that goes on. They were, over the course of the full season, they won, I believe, 9 fewer games than San Antonio and 11 fewer games than Oklahoma City. And that's substantial. That's relevant. That's real. So I think all of it, you have to contextualize and say, like, to me, I look at it and I say, heading into this series, yes, I've heard, you know, you heard it on TV. I think Reggie Miller said it, like, the Knicks are going to be favored heading into the series. And that I arched my eyebrows at and said, I don't think that's right. I think that no matter what, they will not be the favorites heading into the series.
He clarified, he said, in the hearts of fans, that people will be rooting for them. Yes.
Well, and we certainly do appreciate Reggie Miller's support for the New York Knicks. But I would say
who would thought that he'd be the number one cheerleader for the New York Knicks come 2026?
I mean, yeah. I don't think anybody would have seen that outcome. I think a lot of what we've seen over the last month has been fairly surprising. But I would say that in the same way that heading into this round last year, the Indiana Pacers were a fairly heavy underdog to the Oklahoma City Thunder, and matchup, style of play, and what the Pacers had become when healthy with their full team together over the last 4+ months of the season, that proved to be a relevant sample in what wound up being a razor-thin series that the Pacers very well could have won had Tyrese Halliburton not gotten injured at the very beginning of Game 7. So all of which is to say, if the outcome here is, you know, OKC in 5 or San Antonio in 6 or whatever, that would not shock anybody, I don't think. If the outcome is something different than that, and if it is a significantly tighter series than the full season numbers suggest, I don't think we should be shocked by that either. Because what that plus 262 number shows to me, in addition to, yes, the you know, relative weakness of the opponents that the Knicks have played, or the flaws and complications of those opponents, is that the Knicks are hitting on like a 99th percentile outcome of what this build could be. All of the possible bonuses of, you add a stretch big in Karl Towns, who's a playmaking 5. You add wings that can handle more offensive responsibility and then reduce the workload on Jalen Brunson. You add this defensive versatility in terms of ways you can mix and match coverage. You add depth to the bench with Landry Shamet, with Mitchell Robinson healthy, with the way Deuce McBride has developed, and Jordan Clarkson as suddenly a full court pressure defense and offensive rebounding guard, right? Like, I kind of out of nowhere. And all of those sort of smaller margins that you were kicking away a little bit with Tom Thibodeau's insistence on, we're going to lean so heavy minutes on the starters, we're going to leave so heavy minutes on that one lineup, and this one style of play that we generally play all the time. It's going to be Brunson pick and roll on offense, and it's going to be drop coverage on defense with relatively few additions to the menu. Mike Brown has diversified that in a major way. And the low-hanging fruit there, the areas, the margins that were smaller there, they're wider now. And the Knicks have won many of those. So expecting that to continue against teams as good as Oklahoma City and San Antonio, unabated and unchallenged, no, I don't see that. I don't see a world where the Knicks just walk into the series and get dog-walked either, though. What this plus 262 tells me is there's a version of the Knicks that can go toe-to-toe with these Titans out West, and we very well may be seeing it.
Well, I think one of the great things about the Knicks is how different they are, despite very largely similar personnel than they were last year. And a lot of that is to do dealing with Mike Brown and the job that he's done. And you wrote a great piece for Yahoo this week. I want you to hit on it, about how Mike Brown understood the assignment and he aced it, We talk about the rust issue, about having a long layoff between this series and the next one. Well, what about the layoff for Mike Brown? Goes from 2007 to 2026, the largest layoff between championship rounds for a head coach in NBA history. So how has he done it? Like, I mean, we were on this show earlier this season just wondering if the Knicks really had it, that they were really legit. And now not only are they legit, they have the largest 11-game point differential and the largest playoff differential going into the NBA Finals. So what has Mike Brown done to you, or in your eyes, not to you personally, but you know.
Hasn't done anything to me. He's answered questions, fully and thoughtfully in my experience with him. I think what he's done is really what Leon Rose and James Dolan and the powers that be were hoping for in the aftermath of Tom Thibodeau. That was the sort of buzzword was collaboration, right? Like Tom Thibodeau, pretty domineering presence. It's going to like, this is what works. This is how we're going to run things. And it was kind of not necessarily his way or the highway, but like, this is the way. And Mike Brown seems a lot more willing to accept the input and flexible to like, it doesn't necessarily need to be my answer if it's the best answer for how we deploy our resources. And you know, throughout this postseason, he's repeatedly praised his assistant coaches for the game planning that they've done, for taking the point of attack on as like a Chris Gent and TJ Sane on the offensive side of the ball, Brendan O'Connor and Darren Erman on the defensive side, but also like Rick Brunson with the substitution management, minutes management, and different things like that. Like everybody's kind of got their own fiefdoms, and then he's like the CEO, kind of making the determinations at the end of the day, and that way of doing things, and also a pretty open door policy with the players. Like Karl Anthony right. Towns, to hear this, it's told by the Knicks, is like, he's the one that went in game three in Atlanta, was like, what if we did this with the offense? And when CJ McCollum is tearing the Knicks up, it's Josh Hart that goes in and goes, I want to guard him. Like, give me him and I'll take care of that. And there's been a lot of that. And whether it would be the case with, you know, in the same way with Tibbs, I don't know. Who knows, right? But the quickness with which the Knicks are seizing these advantages or opportunities, the way they've been prepared to attack, especially, you know, going into it and into that Philly series, they were like, Joel Embiid, you have nowhere to hide. We are going at you. And we talked about it on the show, right? When Joel Embiid goes down, all right, Tyrese Maxey, you're the only real option here. We are trapping you and we are making your life miserable. All right, you guys are going to do this to us with Josh Hart and, you know, have your center sag off him so that you can muck up our stuff elsewhere. Boom. We have other ways to handle this. Or if we need to get him off the floor and put Shamet in to have a five out lineup, we can do that too. Also, I'm not going to overreact to struggles. I'm not going to, yes, Mikal Bridges, brutal for beginning to the postseason. I'm not just going to throw out the baby with the bathwater there. That guy's still giving effort. He's still working hard defensively. And so I'm going to stick with him and keep trusting him and get rewarded there. Josh Hart, I need to go away from him in game one of the conference finals. I'm going right back to him in game two of the conference finals, and he's going to reward me for that. So like, it's basically just all of these things that some of them were things that Tom Thibodeau did not do in terms of having more schematic versatility on offense and defense. Some of it is like how quickly you're able to flip the script and make the change to make the adjustment in game or between games. Some of it is just getting the buy-in, which at times seemed to be lacking when the Knicks were like, I'm not sure everybody's on the same page with the scout. I don't know if everybody's really locked in on the defensive tendencies or whatever. That's all gone. Like, this team, to a man, is absolutely focused at this point in the season. And like, they deserve plenty of credit for that. Mike Brown is effusive in the credit he gives to his players, to Jalen Brunson, to Karl Anthony Towns, to the leadership in that locker room, to the individual guys staying ready. But I think a lot of that is downstream from him saying, I'm going to give these guys more minutes early in the season. I'm going to experiment and explore more lineup possibilities. I'm going to see what we have using the regular season as a laboratory so that when we get to spring, we have answers. And they have. They have had answers in every one of these series. And I would be very surprised if when we get into the next round, no matter who the opponent is, the Knicks look like they're the lesser prepared or, you know, more sort of dumbfounded team. They might get out talented, they might get out executed, but I don't think they won't be prepared because Mike Brown has brought that level of like commitment, focus, attention to detail, and it's really making them sing on both ends of the floor.
It is a great lesson in how sometimes the backup option or the ninth person to be getting the job opportunity might be the best choice after all. Like next time I'm at a restaurant, I'm like, I'll have the pork chop. Oh, we're out of the pork chop. All right. Well, then I'll get the burger. We're out of the burger. All right. I'll get the pasta marinara. Nope. We're out of that too. And then I end up with a turkey sandwich. Maybe that's going to be the greatest turkey sandwich in the history of the world. And so the fact that they did not get any of these coaches that they wanted to interview and it became the laughingstock of the NBA and they ended up with Mike Brown, well, maybe it is the greatest coaching job we have ever seen. Talk about the greatest point differential going against this OKC reigning champion or the team that they beat in the NBA Cup, the San Antonio Spurs. It remains to be seen, but Mike Brown deserves all of the flowers here after going. Yep.
I just want to make sure, because I know we are moving on and as well, we need to. I just want to make a public entreaty if I can. Mike Brown, after game four against the Cavs, when asked kind of like what it was like after he was let go in Sacramento, which, by the way, another dynamite job, Kings, in terms of how you're locking things down. Basically, if he thought he was going to get another opportunity, what he's talking about these vacations and travels he went on with his wife. He's like, I wasn't really sweating it. An opportunity will come up. In his answer, quote, we actually came to New York City too. We ran around New York City for like 4 days. We went to this one club and we met these young dudes that work on Wall Street. And I was there with them till like 5 a.m. They sent me some pictures and stuff. I'm surprised they haven't sent them to you guys, meaning the media, yet. Hey, guys who work on Wall Street that partied with Mike Brown. You know, your man Divine, on social media, if you want to hit me up, my email address is publicly available on all our Yahoo platforms. By all means, I would love to see the Mike Brown clubbing at 5 a.m. photos if they have not been publicly made available yet. So just putting that out there and, you know, we'll see what the universe provides. But you can't get for something if you don't you can't get something if you don't ask for it first. Mike Brown saying that in that press conference, I was like, incredible. And, we'll see what comes out of the other side of it.
If you need some money, that'll be the next week's big number, is how much money we cobbled together in order to win the bidding war to get these photos. So if they come to you and
probably expense that,
we'll expense it. I think it'll be money well worth it. Yeah. Plus 262 is this week's big number. We're going to dive into, now that we're awaiting the opponent for the New York Knicks as they try to extend this streak, there are some underlying metrics that we want to hone in on as they await their finals opponent. We're going to talk about that right after the break. All right, Dan, this week's big number, plus 262, the point differential for the New York Knicks over the last 11 games, the highest, largest, most destructive plus-minus point differential we have seen in NBA history over an 11-game span, and they want to continue it. But how do they do that? Well, what's your first little number this week on the big number?
First little number this week is plus 7.3. It's Karl Anthony Towns' estimated plus-minus in the 2026 NBA playoffs, according to our pals at Dunks and Threes, Taylor Snar's metrics website. That plus 7.3 metric is second in the entire postseason behind only Victor Wembanyama. It is closer to Wemby than third and fourth place in the playoffs. Alex Caruso and OG Anunoby are to cat. He has been, by this reckoning, the best player in the Eastern Conference playoffs. Now, he did not win Eastern Conference Finals MVP. That was Jalen Brunson. And I was one of the people that voted for Jalen Brunson for Eastern Conference Finals MVP. Huh. So fair, full disclosure there. However, there is a pretty reasonable argument to be made that Towns has been the best player on both ends of the floor in the Eastern Conference playoffs, including the time OG Anunoby missed when he was out. Towns, his scoring is down, but as we've covered here on the show at some length, it's because the shot attempts are down because the offense is running more often through him. He's averaging 7 assists per game in the Eastern Conference playoffs. And shooting the cover off the ball, elite shot-making efficiency, elite defensive rebounding. The defense overall has played up as he's been more comfortable playing at the level of the screen, walling up in the paint. He has been, it feels like the best version of him that we've seen. And that plus 7.3 number reflects that. No individual season of his career, even going back to the all-star, all-NBA days in Minnesota, has he even been above like 6.5. What he's shown now in this stretch feels like the best version of him that we have seen thus far in his career. And I think it's that is something to keep an eye on heading into the playoffs, as far into the finals rather, as a potential swing factor. Like, the Knicks lost his minutes against the Spurs and Thunder during the regular season, but this version of Cat is better than the ones that we have seen in those regular season matchups. So just generally speaking, Tom, what have you seen from Cat in this playoffs? And how do you imagine him or envision him matching up against either of those teams coming out of the West?
He's going to have to be the best player for the Knicks if they want to win the championship. Like, we can talk about Jalen Brunson all we want, but I think he's going to be not neutralized in the next round, but he's going to have a tough time, much harder than he's had at any point in this postseason, in getting to his spots because of the way the Dobermans, the Piranhas of both OKC and San Antonio at the point of attack. I mean, whether it's Stephon Castle or De'Aaron Fox, Devin Vassell, they're going to be hounding him just as hard, if not harder than all the OKC's Dobermans that they have in Cason Wallace and Lou Dort and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Alex Caruso. They're going to want to, you know, cut the head off the snake, so to speak. And so it's going to be incumbent on Karl-Anthony Towns to assert himself as that that lever, the hub of that flex offense, the motion offense that Mike Brown implemented there in the middle of that Atlanta series and changed the entire season, changed the entire paradigm for the New York Knicks. It's not going to be as easy to get into their stuff as you are when you're facing against James Harden and Donovan Mitchell, or Tyrese Maxey and VJ Edgecombe, a rookie, and Kelly Oubre. It's just going to be so much harder to get into your stuff for Jalen Brunson, which means Karl-Anthony Towns is going to be the man on the spot against Chet Holmgren, against Isaiah Hartenstein, against Victor Wembanyama on the other side. It's a much taller task, pun intended, going against OKC and San Antonio than it is against their previous matchups, where they exploited Joel Embiid's slow feet and his inability to keep up athletically as he once was. And so Karl-Anthony Towns, as good as he's been, and he's been the best player or his best version of himself, being that hub, and he is fifth on the Knicks in field goal attempts per game. Fifth.
That's wild.
On the Knicks. Josh Hart has more shots per game than Karl-Anthony Towns in the postseason. So he is going to have to not just be the per-minute superstar out of foul trouble. He hadn't had more than four fouls in any of the four games against the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's going to be so much harder to do that against a team that is going to be hounding Jalen Brunson and then going right at Karl-Anthony Towns offensively in ways that Evan Mobley and Jared Allen can't.
I think the matchup component to that, you're absolutely right to point to, yes, the, because of the difficulty that Brunson's going to be, or the length, the physicality, the size and the ball, the quality of those point of attack defenders, that's, you know, a significant thing for Brunson to deal with. So then Towns has to be the pressure release, right? Matchups are so interesting to me because how will those teams guard him, right? Like, you look at the regular season matchups and there was a lot of like J-Dub guarding Cat. There was a lot of Lou Dort guarding Cat. A lot of Steph Castle guarding Cat. And so like the cross match, as we talked about, where you want to put your center on Hart so that he can sag off and then muck up your interior offense elsewhere, close the driving lanes down for Brunson, all that. And then on the flip side of it, like Cat has mostly guarded the centers across these matchups, Isaiah Hartenstein or Wemby and Luke Kornet. But if you were, they've also shown the willingness, especially against Cleveland, they like crossed the matchups where OG Anunoby guarded Jared Allen, right? And like OG, I can see a lot of OG Anunoby on Wemby or OG Anunoby on Chet, right? Like those sorts of things. So Cat, yeah, you're going to need the best out of him on both ends of the floor. And he has certainly been equal to providing that thus far. So that's going to be something to keep an eye on, no matter who comes out of the West. Second little number this week, it's a very little number. It's plus 0.13, such a small fraction. Plus 0.13 is the Knicks synergy shot making score in the 2026 playoffs. Synergy shot making, a metric created by the folks at Synergy Sports Technology, makes sense, to measure whether someone is scoring more or fewer points per shot than a league average shooter would on the same type of shot. Right. So the general idea is like, are you shooting hotter than expected or colder than expected? And it doesn't necessarily have all of the bells and whistles of like guaranteeing the, you know, specific which shooter and which defender and what the distance of the closeout is. Like, it doesn't have all of the tracking in it. Basically, a shot luck metric, right? According to Synergy's tracking, the Knicks' attempts in this postseason would be expected to produce 1.05 points per shot. They have instead produced 1.18 points per shot, hence plus 0.13. That gap between expectation and reality is the highest of any postseason team since the aforementioned 2016-17 Cavaliers, the LeBron team that went 12-1 in the East on the way to the finals before losing to that year one KD Warriors squad. And it's tied for this. It's tied for second, and this is the second largest gap with the 2013-14 Miami Heat, another LeBron team that in Synergy's database, which goes back to 2004. So we are seeing in the last 20 odd years one of the biggest gaps between expected shot making and actual shot making when it comes to these Knicks. So two things about that. One, Kenny Atkinson vindicated in terms of talking about analytically, maybe the Cavs are actually still up in this series. And then number two, how much of this do you think is the Knicks are a really good shot making team? And how much is the coin is landing on heads a hell of a lot right now for a team on an absolute heater?
Yeah, the interesting thing here is that 2017 Cavs team, because we're talking around this 2017 LeBron Cavs team as the comp. They did have that incredibly large point differential, but because on the other side, the Warriors, the KD Warriors, had equally large point differential. The Warriors actually had 3 days more of rest than the Cavs did. So it's not like that Cavs team also had a long layoff and we were able to see whether the flames that they were throwing were maintaining in that long layoff. Yes, they had a long layoff, but so did the Warriors. And so the rust and rest debate applied to both teams in that instance because they both swept, I think, in the conference finals, and we just waited. I seem to remember like some of us went on like vacation. I don't think I did, but it was like, you could go on a week off vacation and all of our editors were like, what are we going to do for the next week? Because we just had no games and we were just waiting for that Cavs KD Warriors, matchup. And for me, I think Kenny Atkinson is right. Is you can be right in the instance of it is poor logical reasoning to expect that the roulette table is not independent events. I've had this experience with my older brother. We're walking through the Bellagio, I think it was, and the roulette table, as we're walking through to go like eat lunch or something, was incredibly hot on red. And he's like, I'm betting black. I think it's due. And he puts down like $20 on black. And I'm like, Chuck, like, this is insane. Like, you're assuming that the red is too hot and then it's going to go black on this next one, that black is due. It's a coin flip. It's irrelevant. They're independent events. And as I'm ranting about this, Dan, it hits black and he's like, shut up, nerd. And I'm like, yep, you're right. I mean, in these independent 4-game sample sizes, 1-game roulette table sample sizes, the math might not bear out in ways that the nerds win. And I think he got a little too nerdy on this one, is that in a 4-game sample, it doesn't really matter what your expected points per shot was if all that matters is whether they continue that heater in game 4, and they're out now. The Knicks, I think it's worth looking into. Okay, yes, we might have gotten a little lucky on those shots, but is it because there was some sort of process or some sort of reason why we were hitting those tough shots? And a lot of it comes down to Jalen Brunson is like one of the best, if not the best, tough shot maker in the NBA. And so those metrics that compare it to an average player are not properly taking into context that Jalen Brunson, because he's so small out there, he's going to look like he is at a severe disadvantage on a lot of these jumpers or a lot of the contests in the paint, that he should have a 40% chance of making that shot, when in fact it's Jalen Brunson. He's been shooting that shot for 55%. So when you incorporate that, the fact of, hey, it's Karl Anthony Towns who's shooting that 3-pointer, not just any 7-footer, maybe we should look at the shot makers on the Knicks side, that it may continue. I think some of those shots. There's a Mikal Bridges one where he did a step back three pointer at the end of that heater in game three, I want to say it was, against the Cavs. It was just like, I mean, what are you supposed to do as a defense? Do you get the sense, Dan, that there was something magical happening with the Knicks that you felt like the other shoe was going to drop? And I know you've been, you know, watching these Knicks a lot longer than you have professionally.
Right.
That the other shoe did seem to drop all the time. But where do you land on this? That you think more often than not, the people who are saying, look, the Knicks, the Cinderella run, it's been really nice up to this point, but I think it's going to strike midnight on a lot of the shooting luck.
I think there are ways in which that has already happened or can happen, right? Like Mikal Bridges was shooting, I think, literally 75% on two-pointers and 50% on three-pointers during this run. And then the regression kind of came all at once in game four against the Cavs, and he couldn't throw the ball in the ocean. And, you know, that there will be moments like that. Landry Shamet, spoiler alert, is probably not going to shoot 11 for 12 from three in the next series too, right? That said, when you look at the roster construction, the only guy that really can't shoot threes, or guys rather, that can't shoot threes on the roster are the backup centers. It's like Mitchell Robinson, Ariel Hakpourty, and Jeremy Sohan are the only guys who really can't shoot threes. Jose Alvarado, not a particularly strong three-point shooter, but can make them and is like the third string point guard, right? So like, you know, he's a relatively limited contributor. The rest of the rotation, when you talk about Jalen Brunson, Karl-Anthony Towns, Mikal Bridges, OG Anunoby, Landry Shamet, Deuce McBride, Jordan Clarkson even in his minutes, like all of these guys are three-point shooters and not some of them elite, some of them just, you know, credible. But generally speaking, somebody that you, if you see them get a shot, Josh Hart is also your coin flip there, but Josh Hart shot 41% from three on decent volume during the regular season and has shown a capacity multiple times in the playoffs over the course of his career as a Knick to where, like, if you are going to use that ghost strategy against him, he's capable of knocking down four or five in a game and just like turning that into a losing strategy as it happened against Cleveland. So like, is according to the B-ball indexes and metrics, is number one in the NBA in overall shooting talent. And I think that's relevant. Like, again, you're talking about a generalized shot quality metric versus the specifics of these teams, these players, these individuals. And will the Knicks continue to shoot 41% from three and lead the postseason in three-point shooting? I don't know. However, if you're talking about giving these teams, or Jalen Brunson drawing two on the ball, swinging out of it, and then you're like Mikal Bridges for a pull-up mid-ranger or a swing to the corner, and it's Landry Shamet or Deuce McBride with a pretty open catch-and-shoot three in the corner, like, there's a pretty good chance those guys are going to knock those shots down because they are those sorts of shooters. So all of which is to say, yes, they have been running hot, and maybe the next spin of the roulette wheel does turn on black, but I wouldn't be particularly surprised if the shooting numbers still held up pretty well, even against really strong Oklahoma City and San Antonio defenses, because this is a roster full of shooters.
Yeah.
Our third
defensive rating of the regular season, Atlanta 10th, Cleveland 15th, and Philly 17th, right? So like not only maybe the luck could go the other way, but they're also going to be facing one of the two of the best defenses in the NBA in the next round. So it's going to be an uphill battle, but that's the NBA finals. So your third little number.
Yeah. Third and final little number this week is, we'll go to the other side of the ball. It's 31%, which is what Knicks opponents have shot from 3-point range in the playoffs, according to Cleaning the Glass. 31.7% for the Hawks in the first round, 33 for Philly in round two, and just 28.8% for the Cavs in the Eastern Conference finals. That is a break from the regular season where Knicks opponents shot a little better than league average. And again, as we mentioned, the Knicks finished 10th in non-garbage time defensive efficiency during the regular season. And 31% from three through three rounds is the lowest three-point accuracy against in the 2026 playoffs, which is why the Knicks currently lead the NBA playoffs in non-garbage time defensive efficiency. So again, this is the other side of the coin, right? Where like the Knicks opponent and the Knicks they give up a lot of threes. Part of the defensive scheme that Mike Brown favors is we are going to protect the paint first, second, and third, and then trust in our ability to rotate, get back out to shooters, And, you know, on a string, connect and contest, right? And then finish possessions with rebounds. However, if you, if a little bit of regression to the mean comes in that way, especially, I think Oklahoma City is shooting 37-38% from three in from the playoffs in San Antonio. Also plenty of credible shooters there. If that flips a little bit, that could be a major swing metric in the next round too. Like, and force the Knicks to change things up defensively in a way that they might not like to, because they would prefer to wall off the paint first and then flow back out. If you're busting them up from outside, maybe that makes Mike Brown shake things up a little bit.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we're talking about, you know, running hot. I mean, look at Alex Caruso in this Western Conference Finals. Looks like a guy that won't ever miss again. But against the New York Knicks, it might be a different story. And that shot regression going towards the mean, it might happen against the New York Knicks in ways that, you know, playoff James Harden has been they're facing against James Harden in the second round of the third round of the playoffs. Donovan Mitchell, you go on down the line. It wasn't their sharpest performance. And so against this Western Conference finalist or the team that comes out of the West, they're going to be pretty banged up. And so I would also suspect that the Knicks might be continuing this hot run here, because whoever is coming out of the West is going to be so beat up and having to deal with all of the fatigue coming out of the West that maybe they're not going to have their legs underneath them in ways that, if all of those Knicks haters out there are going to be like, hey, next round, it's going to be a totally different story. I'm not so sure, man. Like, you look at some of the fatigue factor that we're going to be seeing, especially if the Western Conference Finals goes seven, goes the distance, the Knicks might continue to see a lot of shooting luck go their way on the other end of the floor. So this is another piece of data that, you know, I'm the guy who satirically says every championship should have an asterisk, because if you're going to win the championship, a lot of stuff has to go your way. And it same goes for this Knicks team, is that in order to have the best point differential over the last 11 games in NBA history, some things need to go your way. Like, Landry Shamet has to be 12 of 13 from downtown in order for you to get to this point differential. And everybody else on the opponents has to forget how to play basketball, or at least shoot the ball at a high rate. Some of those luck factors have boosted their plus minus differential over the last 11 games in this heater that they're going, 11 straight wins. But at the same time, they're doing it to such a degree that even if you take 50 points away, like I said earlier, all of Jalen Brunson's baskets in the fourth quarter during this 11 game run, they're still the most impressive 11 game team in NBA history. So you can even say, oh, if you knock that opponent 3-point percentage a couple notches and it becomes league average, it doesn't matter. The Knicks are still blowing it out.
Yeah, and to your point, already Devin Vassell and Stephen Castle have played more minutes than any Knick. And after game six, which we're recording a few hours before game six on Thursday, I'd imagine that Champagne and Victor Wembanyama and, you know, maybe De'Aaron Fox as well will be up there too. So, like, there's and that's it, if it just goes six. You know, and then we're talking about heading into game seven. Like, the Thunder obviously generally go deeper. Mark Daigneault has had a long rotation and has extended his rotation even in the postseason, and, you know, finds ways to keep his guys' minutes down. But there, yeah, if this goes, you know, into six and it's San Antonio, you know, obviously that, you know, if they're able to extend it, goes to the distance in seven, once again, the Knicks would be walking in with a significant advantage in terms of how fresh their legs are and the minutes total. And yeah, that could turn into front rim jumpers, right? It wouldn't be shocking to see that happen. Certainly not as shocking as almost anything else we've seen out of the New York Knicks out of the last month. It's a pretty wild time.
Well, I thought that we would be sitting here on the eve of the NBA Finals saying, you know what? The Western Conference Finals was the finals. OKC versus San Antonio. Whoever comes out of the East, whatever. This is the real finals on the West, but that's not the case anymore. I don't think anyone's saying that right now, thanks to that plus 262 from the New York Knicks over the last 11 games. It is a very worthy Eastern Conference champion going against whoever comes out of the Western Conference. I can't wait for it. And a lot of people are bemoaning a lot of the falls, the flopping that's happening in this postseason. Adam Silver was asked about it on the Pat McAfee show. And he kind of admitted, yes, there's something there that we're trying to, you know, monitor and try to keep in check, but We're going to support our referees. They're doing an incredible job. Well, I've got a lot to say about this whole fall thing, the flopping thing. Wrote about it last week on Yahoo Sports on Friday.
Oh,
wrote
had about you? It again. I hadn't heard about that. I wasn't aware that you dug into the topic. Oh, interesting.
Oh, my phone is just nonstop. And I'm going to get into some of the messages I've been getting behind the scenes a little bit here that might be interesting for our audience here. So we're going to talk about all that stuff coming up after the break. I'm going to back up a bit here, Dan, for this week's big number final segment and talk about the KOC show on Thursday, Dan. I just before air, all the talk going into that game that day was about the flopping from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. There was already memes, tons of videos that were going viral showing about him flopping. And some video said, Dan, it went like, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander flopped on every single one of his shots tonight, and it showed 7 shots. And I was like, I mean, that's not true. So what I did was I watched every one of his shots in that game, and I charted it. And I said, oh, he's fallen on like 27% of his shots in that game. That is a straw man. Like that whole he fell or flopped on every one of his shots in that game. I was like, on KOC show, I was like, it is such a misnomer to think that he falls on every single one of his shots. It's not even the majority of his shots. Jalen Brunson falls on a bunch of his shots. It's no different than Joel Embiid, who falls on a bunch of his shots. And Dan, I was pretty, I was defending SGA in that segment. And then after I got off air, I was like, you know what? I need to actually dig deeper here. What if you, like, it's not enough to say Jalen Brunson falls too. Like, there are degrees to this. So I went back into Synergy and I watched every one of Jalen Brunson's shots in the postseason and compared it to every one of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's shots in the postseason. And it was double. Like, Jalen Brunson had half as many falls. And I'm using the term falls for a reason. Flopping is subjective, falls are not. And so My brain goes to, can we bring some actual data to this conversation and have some evidence-based discussion around the Shai Gilgeous-Alexander flop discourse? And so I brought in the data with the fall information about he fell this many times on this many shot attempts, and it is this percentage of his overall shot attempts. And then I was like, I don't think Jalen Brunson's enough. I need to go look at James Harden. And if I have time, I'm going to go to Donovan Mitchell. And I was like, you know what? I should also do Wemby. So I did those 4 other players, compared it to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and wrote an article for it on Friday. And it went bonkers. Dan, I was not prepared. I thought it would be interesting. And I did this on purpose just to pull back the curtain. I did not tweet any of the data. I made sure that people would read the story, and I didn't want it to be one of these things where I just tweet out the graphic and then have no one read any of the context that I put in. And so I made sure that when people click the link, they could read my article and read all of the different context, explanation, the background info, the reasons why he's falling, all of this stuff that I wrote in there. But it got into the zeitgeist and in ways that I had to follow up again and say, like, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is maybe the smartest player in the league, right? He's an absolute maestro when it comes to footwork and getting guys off balance. But he's also intelligent in there's a margin that I'm going to exploit. I am going to do it. If the NBA is not going to fine me or reprimand me or penalize me for flopping and I'm not going to get a call on 50% of my falls, then I'm going to keep doing it. And so that was Monday's piece. And just to update everybody, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has now fallen 48 times in this postseason. It's the most among the players that I tracked, and it's by far the most. And so not only does he fall the most among those 5 players, at a high percentage, it is by a wide margin. And so I'm not saying that he's flopping 11% here. You're seeing how often does he foul on shots that aren't a whistle on it. He's falling 11% of those. I'm not saying he's flopping on 11% because a lot of them, there is contact and a lot of them, his legs are getting taken out. A lot of it is he's falling on someone's foot and he's going to the ground. But I think it's worth, I mean, above all things, you know me, man, I am going to bring data into the conversation and I'm going to try to find evidence of whatever is the discourse and try to come in with a unique angle. And I think this is interesting, is that he falls more than any other player in this sample, more than Jalen Brunson and James Harden, who have a pretty big reputation for falling a lot and flopping a lot. And yet it's Shea, the two-time MVP, who does it more than any of those guys. And so I think that's worth talking about. And I wish it wasn't so effective on refereeing. And I wish it wasn't a two-time MVP who does this the most, because I don't like when guys are on the ground all the time. I don't like flopping or embellishing contact and hitting the decks to get these free throws. And so I do wish that it was extricated from the game. But I also think, like, if you're getting a hard foul and you end up on the ground, I'm not going to be like, hey, that's not basketball. But I just think that we need to get rid of flopping out of the game. And if shedding a light on how often these players are falling helps to do that, then I think that's journalism. I think it's journalism to bring evidence-based analysis to cover the sport that we love at the biggest stage that we love. And I think this was a huge part of the conversation before I wrote about it. And I just wanted to bring some evidence to it. And that's my soapbox to start this segment. So I'm guessing you have questions.
I have a few. Well, first I have a comment, which is I really like that you thought you were defending Shea Gilgeous-Alexander and then the entire internet called a foul on you. I think that was really wonderful that you were like, I'm defending and whistle. Yeah, exactly. So being on the other side of the playoff bracket, right? I'm with the Eastern Conference Series and I'm like on the off mix. I'm watching the games, but I'm not like as, I haven't been as intently watching as I've been covering the Eastern Series. So I get now why you decided to look into it after seeing the rage bait tweets of, every attempt. And you say, well, no, and I want to like bring some rigor to that. I totally get that. I guess the question that I've got is, after going through this process and seeing what the response has been, has any of the pushback you've received seemed to you like, oh, that is actually where that's another area for me to explore, or that is a potential explanation or justification or whatever that holds some water, as opposed to just sort of like, yeah, there's going to be the bad faith arguing. There's going to be, this is being used to satisfy an agenda on one side or the other. Like, has any of it struck you as like, oh, this is cause for deeper or further inquiry?
Dan, I think you share the same anxiety that I have when it comes to writing on these things is, oh man, did I miss this? Did I miscalculate
this?
Sure,
yeah.
Did I forget some important detail that is explaining this that is going to make me look like a moron when it goes public? I had that same issue when I saw the data and I was like, did I get this wrong? Because it is so extreme, the fall rate, which he's at over 50% of his fouled shots he falls on. And it's higher than Jalen Brunson and James Harden and Donovan Mitchell by like double, triple percentage wise. And so that was my first worry, is that I just missed this. But then I got a message, I'll just say, from an executive with another team that shared second spectrum data that showed they track this. The cameras that the teams have fall rate.
Right.
They can see who falls the most per game and falls the most per 100 possessions. I don't have access to that data because I don't have a login for Second Spectrum, which is the like souped up version of what you see publicly. And so teams do track this. They do monitor how often players fall. And the cameras are doing this too. And it is, from the data that I saw in the postseason, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander leads all players in fall rate and total falls. And number two on that list, from what I saw, was AJ Mitchell. And so it's not just Shea Gilgeous-Alexander. It's AJ Mitchell also falls a lot when he's driving, when he's out there. And now he's injured, and he's out for game six. And so there was this other piece of the story that I made mention of is Caitlin Cooper at Basketball She Wrote had did an incredible story on Pascal Siakam. And in his mind, why he falls so much on his jumper is to reduce the force on his knees and his ankles and his feet, and to disperse that force onto a larger area of his body, which has been argued for Joel Embiid. Chris Herring wrote this great piece for ESPN years ago that tracked Joel Embiid's dives onto the floor. And they had an explanation for this, is like, he's been taught to fall a certain way. And other people said martial arts, in certain like divisions of martial arts, to fall, you want to land and the way that it basically pancakes and all that force and that gravity is impacting more square footage than just on your feet or on your knees. So I made sure to put that all in there, is that I'm not saying this is all flopping. What I am saying is there's the possibility that it's hard fouls, the possibility that he's flopping and that he's diving on purpose to get the call. There's a possibility that he does it to protect his joints. And to answer your question, the first insecurity thing I had was, did I get the data wrong? And from what I can tell, there hasn't been another piece that says, actually, when I watched the film, he fell this and Tom got it wrong. Second, and the team data backed it up too. The other things are the different reasons for why he falls so much. I wanted to hit on all of them. And it does seem like, I don't feel like I missed something tremendously. What I feel is I shed light and provided evidence to the hottest button topic in the playoffs. And some people aren't going to like that, Dan. I understand why Thunder fans are upset, but at the same time, the Thunder are up 3-2 going into the NBA Finals. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander is doing a pretty good job. And the referees haven't changed their whistle in this, that he's not getting flopping fines. And the NBA, Adam Silver on Pat McAfee was like, yep, we have mechanisms in place to try to monitor this. And they haven't come down and said he is guilty of a egregious flop and therefore we're going to fine him. I don't think that's going to happen, Dan. Just an addendum on that. The NBA has not fined a player in the postseason for flopping since Marcus Smart in the bubble. It's been 6 years since the NBA has, and they have the power to do this, to penalize a player for flopping in-game and post-game. They haven't done it in 6 years. And the last time that they had actually done a post-game flopping fine was, you guessed it, Sacramento Kings guard Malik Monk in November of this season. Against the Memphis Grizzlies in the lowest stakes game possible. And here we have game six of the NBA Western Conference Finals. I don't think that Adam Silver is going to flop or fine Shea Gilgeous-Alexander for flopping. I do think what I would like to see is less foul calls both ways. Stephon Castle, also guilty of the same thing, is less rewarding of the falling onto the ground, hoping for a foul call. And I think that's much more reasonable of an expectation to see the referees not calling those fouls. And in by doing that, I think that will reduce the behavior, is that I think they're responding to incentives that Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, by the math, by watching this, empirically, he has gotten a foul call on 50% or more of the times he hits the deck on a foul, on a shot. So if I'm him, I'm going to keep on doing that.
Yeah, and to your point, like the if the incentive changes, like the natural consequence of if you fall and you don't get the call is if you miss that shot, you're giving up a fast break opportunity the other way, right? Think about how often. Now, I guess potentially less damaging when you're talking about Shea in the mid-range than when you think about like a driver falling under the basket, right? But that idea of like, think about how often you see that. Again, being with the Knicks, thinking about Karl-Anthony Towns, those drives to the basket where he goes down on a heap in a heap on the baseline, and then it's a 5-on-4 the other way, right? But with the positioning of Shea, maybe less damaging because he's able to get back up and get into the play a little quicker. But in general, if that is a no call and the Thunder are giving up a 5-on-4 the other way, and that is potentially damaging to your fast break defense or your transition opportunity, like you're giving up, they're getting into their a higher percentage look earlier in the shot clock, et cetera, stressing out your defense as they need to get back more and more. Eventually the incentive structure changes, right? And so that is interesting to me, that potential, if the officiating mandate is slightly different, then people are going to respond as a result of it. We hear about this across sports, right? Players and coaches just want to know what to expect, right? If we know what the rules are and what's being called, the way it's getting called, we can adjust as we go along. If it feels like it's not being called the same way both ways, then that's where you wind up with these, there's space for conspiracy theory, there's space for agita, and the issues that we've got going forward. But like, so to me, I look at it and I say, yeah, as to your point, the articles that you wrote and that I read this morning, because I wanted to make sure I was prepared for this, are not accusations. This is, I looked at how often these different people fell down. And there, yes.
Which is what an amazing, I said
like
this
distillation. Yeah.
I said this to Kev. I was like, I just wish the NBA would track this publicly so I wouldn't have to do this by hand. And they do it in Second Spectrum data, and all these coaches and executives, they have access to this data. And I did this hand charting because I did not have access to that data. And on one hand, I'm like, is this what my life has become? But I think also part of my mentality here is, well, let's just bring the facts to light. You know, like, let's just bring some facts and information to this discourse so it isn't just a bunch of groundless, baseless yelling and swirling in this conversation. I just wanted to bring some information, some data, some facts into the discussion. And the facts are that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander falls more than any other NBA player on his shots, that I could tell. And that the teams that have been seeing this data are also backing up. So, Dan, like you, I'd imagine covering Jalen Brunson for as long as you have, like, you think about this stuff. And now that you have a little bit more data, I think you're thinking about it the right way is, well, there is a cost to doing this. Is falling on the ground, it takes a while to get up. But to your point, on a mid-range, not only you're closer to your opposing basket, but the ball needs to go into the air, and then on a jumper, it bounces. And so the time that it takes for the ball to come off your hand, hit the rim, bounce off, and then get rebounded is way longer than if you flopped on a layup and then the team gets the quick rebound and goes the other way and you have to go right. 90 feet as opposed to 60 feet. Those things, I guarantee you, have been discussed in coaching circles and coaching rooms and coaching staffs. Is like, hey, Shai, if you're going to fall, we'd rather you do it at the three-point line, or we'd rather you do it not only at the three-point line because of the extra value of the three-point shot, and you might get three shots on that foul, but also you're allowing yourself time to get back up and recover in ways that doesn't get exploited if it's you're flopping or laying out on a layup. And that, I think, with the Karl Anthony Towns discussion is relevant in this upcoming finals matchup, where Stephon Castle does this a lot more than I think Spurs fans would like to admit. And so it's not just Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, AJ Mitchell. It's also Stephon Castle doing this too in ways that we're going to be talking about this in the NBA finals, I'm pretty sure. And it's not because I'm going to be writing about it. I'm just saying now that it's front of mind, I think it is going to be a talking point, whether Shai is in it or Stephon Castle is in it.
Tom, respectfully, I don't know if you know how editors work. I feel like you're going to probably be writing about it now that this has been successful. I feel like you're going to need to be paying attention to this some more. I guess that would maybe the last question that I would ask you about it is, like, now having gone through it expanded the data set out from Shai to a handful of other players and then tracked that and compared it. I guess what, if anything, is like interesting to you as like a further expansion of it? Like, I guess what, whether it's like the data that you don't have that you would like to, or an area that you would like to look at if you had more time, is there like a natural outgrowth of this that you see as like the next iteration of it?
All right. So Matt Wong, my editor, if you're listening now.
Our editor, yeah.
Yep. You know this. I'm always thinking next column ahead is what is the follow-up here. And so what I would think, Matt, is Stephon Castle. I need to watch all of the Stephon, because I didn't do this initially because I did Wemby as the representative there. And I wanted to look at, because there was a lot of accusations that he falls a lot more than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. But Stephon Castle has done it quite a bit. I would look at him. I would also look at defense following a fall. I don't have this data, and man, this is a lot harder than just watching 1,300 shots, which is what it was, and hand charting it, is what happens after those falls.
Yeah.
I would like to see that information, because we know what happens on those free throws, but we don't know on those missed shots that there is no call, what happens to your defense. And the other one I want to do, I won't say who asked me this, but a prominent NBA reporter asked me, well, what about D Wade in the 2006 NBA Finals? And so, Dan, that was another, maybe an offseason project, is if Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is running, did Dwayne Wade walk so he could run? And I suspect that if I look back in the 2006 NBA Finals against the Mavs and all the free throws that D Wade got, I'd imagine you'd see a high fall rate, which is, I guess we can end on this. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the best scorer in the NBA. He's two-time MVP. If he got rid of two of those flops a game or got rid of half his free throws a game, he'd still be one of the best players in the league and probably still in the MVP conversation. He's an all-time great player. I just think for him and for Stephon Castle, Karl-Anthony Towns, Wemby even, I think fans would want to see players not have to flop and laying on the ground to get foul calls. I think it's not a great look for the league. And I think the NBA should have already been fining players for this activity. But Shai does it in a very intelligent and clever, not clever, like he's trying to pull one over on us. Shai is smart. If he flails his arms like this, and cartoonishly falls to the ground, he's going to get reprimanded for flopping. But if he just goes down in a heap, I don't think the NBA has grounds to fine him under the letter of the law. And so he's doing this in a way that protects his body, protects his team, and protects himself from getting any sort of penalty. But I just wish that we would see these guys on their feet more. And so maybe that's the next thing, is Dwayne Wade, 2006 NBA Finals. And then I could have the Miami Heat fans hate me on this one. But yeah,
sure.
That's do you have any, do you have any, I would like to see who has never fallen in the NBA. Like, is there a player that just refuses to do this?
Right.
I guess in the way that Wemby talks about it, is it the most ethical player in the league that just will not fall?
Yeah, listen, Charlie Conway at the beginning of Mighty Ducks, like, he won't take the dive. Like, you got to respect it. Who is our most honorable participant? Yes, I think that's the final piece in the story, in the puzzle. I love that.
Then they're dumb. That's the other thing. And then they're dumb. They're like, why? You don't like winning? You don't like what Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is, the two-time reigning MVP and on his way to the NBA championship? That's the tough thing here is I don't think Thunder fans are going to accept this, but I do think that Shai is doing this for a reason, because it works, like I wrote on Monday. And you can complain all you want, Spurs fans or anybody else in the NBA, but like, it works. It does. If you want evidence, just look at a team, a guy, Jalen Brunson, who when he takes charges, is he on 2 feet when he takes those charges? No, he's falling because he knows that it's way more likely that the NBA refs are going to call a foul if you fall to the deck on a charge call than if you just stand on your feet and wobble backwards, even if the impact is the exact same. Falling works, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander getting 50%+ foul rate on those falls is evidence, as well as Wemby, who's 80%, by the way, on just way fewer falls. He had 10 falls compared to 46 for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It works. And so I wish it didn't work as well as it does, but hey, as long as we have human refs, we're going to have those kind of biases at play. So Dan, this was a very big number episode with a lot of minutes on this one. But this is the finals are upon us, and the Miami Heat, you're going to be able to sit and wait for that D-Wade 2006 finals for another day. I'm not going to do it right now. I've got more important things on my plate. But yeah, it's weird. One last thing. When you watch shots at 4x speed, the actual, when you watch like a real game without it sped up, it looks like it's in slow-mo. Your brain, I don't know if you've ever done this, is watch an NBA game at like 1.5x or 2x or highlights or tracked data in this way. But when you do it 4x speed to try to see if a guy fell on that play, the actual game looks like it's in slow-mo. It's wild.
That's super weird. I feel like, Tom, you're maybe breaking your brain to do this. I don't know that I want to suggest that you keep going, but I would imagine the incentive structure of how successful the pieces were will indicate that you're going to keep falling down on this. And so we'll have to go from there. But yeah, I would say, Heat fans, you just sit tight, keep waiting. And we'll see where that all lands after the playoffs, maybe. Listen, Knicks are in the finals. Tom is, making enemies all over the Southeast United States. What a time to be alive.
It's going to do it for us today on the big number. thank you so much, everybody. We're going to do this again next week. Reminder that all of the NBA content at Yahoo can be found on YouTube at Yahoo NBA. Kevin O'Connor Show, Dunker Spot, the big number. Thank you to Brad. Thank you, Emmy. Thank you to Ryan, the entire squad behind the scenes, for making the show a reality. Thank you so much. Enjoy game 6. Enjoy the rest of the playoffs here. We'll talk again next week.